Today is Wednesday, May 23rd, 2007. My name is Sandy Thaler, and I am an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Department Oral History Project. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Teresa Adams, professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering and director and principal investigator of the Midwest Regional University Transportation Center. She is also affiliated with the following programs: Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, Center for Human Performance and Risk Analysis, Spatial Information and Analysis Consortium, the Transportation Engineering and City Planning Program, the Transportation Management and Policy Program, the Wisconsin Highway Research Program, Wisconsin Traffic Operations and Safety Laboratory, and the Wisconsin Transportation Center. Dr. Adams also directs the Center for Freight Infrastructure Research and Education. Hello.
Hello.
We're going to start the interview with some questions about your early life. If you would talk about where and when you were born, describe your childhood, your early schooling, talk about any family members or teachers or others who might have had an influence on your career choice.
I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on September 11, 1958. My parents are both from Pittsburgh and were born in Pittsburgh and raised in Pittsburgh, as were their family before them. We were a military family. I have five brothers and sisters. I am the middle daughter. I have an older brother and an older sister. We're all scattered around the United States at this point. We were raised primarily up and down the east coast of the United States in various military compounds across the, or military bases across the U.S. We also lived in Utah, out at Dugway, Utah, and then in Germany for a while. So I am primarily what's known as a third culture kid, who's used to moving around quite a bit and making friends quickly and assimilating into groups of people and working with lots of different people from different backgrounds and with different interests and used to learning to get along with people that are different. I went to school in lots of different schools. I went to four different high schools in my life. Interestingly, I went to first grade in Edgewood, Maryland, in the same school district that I graduated from high school, but I never went to school anywhere in between in Maryland. So I started and graduated from the same school district, but didn't go to school in any other years. Probably in my, I loved school, especially in first grade. My mother says I figured out that if you did something, misbehaved, you had to stay after school and help the teacher. And I figured this out, and so I intentionally did this in first grade so I could stay after and help the teacher clean the chalkboard and so on. So I always loved school when I was a child. And I had trouble reading, was very good in first grade, but then after that, for some reason, developed something that made it very difficult for me as a reader. So it's something I've had to overcome and throughout my education, but always really good at math and science, and just loved, you know, these things that were sort of puzzles. I taught myself how to do sewing and crocheting and knitting just by reading books and, you know, and puzzles and things like that. I would just love that stuff and things that you do with your hands. As I grew up then, and moving in military bases, I can remember something of a culture shock, if you can have something like that. This was in the early 70s, and we were in Anniston, Alabama, and there was still some of the civil rights unrest in around that military base there. I went to school at the Anniston High School, and then after about a year and a half, their typical tour of duty in certain places. And then my dad came home and he said, well, we're transferred to the Washington, D.C. area. And then he was stationed at the Pentagon. And so we moved from the South to the north, so one of the probably least progressive to one of the most progressive school districts in the country. And I can remember getting there and didn't have anything to wear, because I had come from a place where girls were still supposed to wear skirts and dresses, and it was still quite, you know, in the early 60s or 60s, and then went to a place where it was jeans and, you know, big combs in their back pocket and those braided wallets, and it was just sort of in that early mid-70s. And so I can remember coming home after the first day and, "Mom, we have to go shopping. This isn't going to work." So that was, and then it was a little bit of catching up, but I really enjoyed math. I remember that was probably the teacher there that was probably one of my favorite math teachers that I remember. His name was Mr. Dittman, Dittman. And he was my algebra teacher, and I kind of got hooked on math at that point. And that was really in eighth grade. Mm. So it wasn't until eighth grade that I really started getting turned on by math. And then from there, it was geometry and calculus, and so some of the math courses I really liked. When I graduated from high school in Maryland, then my dad got stationed in Germany, and we lived at a few military bases in Germany, and University of Maryland has a branch campus in Munich, and I went to school there for 2 years and just took liberal arts, really. But to me, liberal arts was chemistry and physics and math, and because it was just a liberal arts school, 2 year liberal arts school. And then from there, I came back to the United States, and we settled in Pittsburgh, where my parents were both from, and where my dad had that was declared as our home state, and so we were actually state residents of Pennsylvania. And so in that point, with having five brothers and sisters and parents in military with a strong desire to send all of us to school, and so we were always had not everything you wanted, but certainly everything you needed, and education was a really high priority to both of my parents, and so a lot of their savings and their goals were really to send their children to school and to have the money and not have to have the kids take loans. And so at any rate, that meant I went to a state school. And so I ended up at University of Pittsburgh. And how I got into engineering is kind of a good question. I guess when I was in Maryland, or at the University of Maryland in Munich, and of course, like I said, liberal studies to me was calculus and physics and chemistry. But my calculus teacher, who was my advisor, had looked at the courses I took and said, "You know, with these courses, you could go into engineering when you transfer," because that was a big concern, was to make sure that the students of military and embassy kids and who were with their parents in Europe and from all over Europe, when they did go back to the United States, then they could transfer in and wouldn't lose too much time. And so I knew that. And then the other thing that my dad had done when he was retiring, and had always was looking actually for another career for himself, and had sort of put together a list of things that he thought were up and coming professions and needs within our nation, and concerns that were emerging and where new fields of careers would be developing. And one of them was environmental engineering. And so this was in the late 70s. And of course, to me, having taken two or three geology courses in my liberal studies, had sort of interpret this as what we know as tree huggers right now. And so I decided that's a good one. And so I looked into that and found out that was in civil engineering. And of course, then I enrolled in civil engineering and started taking civil engineering courses and really kind of liked them. It was sort of fun stuff, more puzzles, and particular structural engineering, which is a really fun analytical subject. And when I got into what I thought was environmental engineering, it was actually sanitary engineering, and that was wastewater treatment, and decided, no, that's not quite what I wanted to do. But I still like generally all of civil engineering, and so when I first finished, when I graduated from University of Pittsburgh, I actually was a structural engineer. And when my first job was at Alcoa. Alcoa has it there in the early 80s. Alcoa had their headquarters in downtown Pittsburgh. And my first job was a what they called a construction engineer for Alcoa. And we were, that construction department was basically the custodians of the mill plants and Alcoa's works for making aluminum and the various various things that they made with aluminum manufacturing. And so I took care of industrial buildings for them. And a lot of what we were doing, because it was a period in the early 80s when there wasn't a lot of new construction going on, but it was a lot of rehabilitation of various buildings and reconstruction and the reorganization of the enterprise in general. And and so we did a lot of as-builts, and we did a lot of remodeling and things like that. So unfortunately, I didn't get involved in any of the new construction activities in there. Then that was when Reagan was first came into office, and there was a lot of downsizing across the whole country and a lot of industries. And so Alcoa went through a few waves of layoffs, and I didn't get laid off in the first wave after only being there for about 6 months. But then in the second wave of layoffs, they just pretty much cleared out that department. They only kept people who were doing CAD systems. It was very new at that time. So they had kept people who could do the electronic drawings and things like that. And only the people in the construction department that had been with the company for a long time and sort of knew in their heads a lot about where the different facilities were and what was going on in them and different issues. And so at that point, I had already been going to graduate school at Carnegie Mellon because Alcoa would pay for that. And so I had already been taking courses at Alcoa. And then so I went and visited the faculty there. And when I first enrolled there and started taking classes, of course, they were suggesting that I might want to come full time and get a master's degree or go to graduate school. And at the time, I was, you know, I wanted to practice engineering like many of the students now want to do as well.
I'm going to interrupt you 1 minute.
Sure.
Did you pick Carnegie Mellon for a number of reasons? I mean, I realize it was close, but was there something about the engineering program that you were interested in, or just?
Carnegie Mellon is, it was close, it was mm-hmm. convenient. It's has a very well-respected engineering program, and so that was in my own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And it was expensive to go, but Alcoa was paying for it. Mm-hmm. And as long as I got an A or B, and that wasn't too hard to do mm-hmm. for someone who had finished quite well in their undergraduate. So I wasn't too worried about that commitment. And so it was in my own backyard. And interestingly enough, you know, I know now students are very, very selective on their graduate schools, and they apply to many of them and seem to get into many of them. And interestingly, I only applied to one. and it's a very kind of a silly, embarrassing story that I got the acceptance letter, and it just said, you know, we're accepting you into the program, blah, 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 and without any other further instructions. And here I am, pretty naive at the whole deal, and didn't know I was supposed to tell them. It didn't say that in there. And, and so I show up, okay, here I am. I didn't get anything else from you guys. And they're looking at me like, well, you didn't tell us you were coming. And I said, well, you didn't tell me. You're the only school I applied to. And they're like, oh, this was different, okay. So, and it was a little bit different because I was, throughout the grad school, I was the local girl. Everybody thought I was the local girl. And here I am, not really any different than the rest of them, you know, one of these third culture kids who are running around and assimilating. But because I was born there and because I had some relatives in the area, I was the local girl. So that was kind of fun for me to have that role, because I never had that role in any of my lifetime. So, and I enjoyed it there. And so
after... But you didn't go full-time right away.
Well, not right away, until I got laid off at Alcoa. And then I took a job as just a consultant, a part-time consultant, for this place called Industrial Light and Energy or something like that. And they did aluminum extrusions, and they were making windows for industrial buildings and stuff. And so I did some structural analysis on these, their sections, and looking at, you know, the way they probably should design these sections for extrusions for the various applications that you could use for these things. And so I would do that for a few weeks or a few hours a week, and until I started graduate school. And then I started graduate school, and initially I did geotechnical engineering, which is another part of civil engineering, and I was doing some soil dynamics in which is really sort of wave propagation through soils, and looking at how very large, massive structures might interact with each other in earthquakes or other types of shear forces, and how when one gets vibrating in the resonant frequency, and how that might interact with others, and whether or not there were concerns about the placement of these large, massive structures. And so I did that. That was funded by the National Science Foundation, and I enjoyed that. That was very computationally intense, and I would, this was when personal computers, of course, this was in the early 80s, or the mid 80s, and personal computers were fairly prevalent then, and the university had several laboratories of them, and I would I wrote the program, the analysis program, and would try all kinds of configurations and of the structures in all kinds of various properties of the soil, and I'd get just load this up into this room full of computers, and literally I had them all going, and you know, it'd be crunching and crunching for hours to get one point on a graph, and so I would just, you know, get them all set, and then go away and have dinner and fun with my friends, and then, you know, the other grad students, and then pop back in there around 11 o'clock at night and start them over again, so that when I came back the next day, I got my data. And so that was sort of my master's degree, and I finished that in 86. And then at the time, the faculty asked me, do you want to, you know, would you like to stay on? And you thought about getting a PhD, and so I thought about it for a while, and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting, I could do that. And so I worked on another project that was funded by National Science Foundation. At the time, I had said I really wanted to go a little more into the area of artificial intelligence, and that was in sort of the mid-80s, and Carnegie Mellon was doing quite a bit in that. And so I did another project, and that was an expert system for retaining walls, and that was still geotechnical, but it was a little more sort of construction and management type activities. And so I worked on that, and worked with some of the faculty in the artificial intelligence lab and used some of their tools that they had developed, and did some knowledge acquisition, and developed some frameworks and pulled that together and talked with people in industry, and finished that up in a few years. And then I started interviewing, looking for jobs. And
now, did you at this point, were you looking in the private sector, the academic world, or both, or did you
academic?
Know? Oh, academic.
Yeah,
at that point.
At that point, okay. For the most part, that was the career choice at the time when you get a PhD. In at the time when you get a PhD in civil engineering, you were really grooming yourself for an academic position, particularly if you follow through. And at the time, it wasn't, people weren't necessarily expected to have a postdoc like they are now. Mm-hmm. A little more in our department now, we're looking for candidates who have a postdoc, a little more experience in writing proposals and directing projects themselves. So while I had basically conducted two research projects on my own that were funded by the National Science Foundation, I didn't have as much experience writing proposals, I think, as faculty do or the candidates do now. So, but nevertheless, that was the way it was in the late 80s. And so I had, I actually interviewed at North Carolina State and at Madison and sent out my resume to other places, which I can't really remember now. Had looked at places where it would be nice to live. That was one of the criteria. And good schools. And so, of course, Madison pops up to the top of the list. And then got a job offer here. And so I like to tell people they imported me. And I was the first woman faculty in the department.
And what year was that?
That was 1989. And I like to tell people that they doubled the number of women in the College of Engineering the year they hired me. And that wasn't because this they hired me, but they hired two other women at that same year. And so we were the first crop. And I think the other, at least one of the other two was the first in the department. I think that was Regina Murphy. I think she came in the same year. In chemical engineering, you probably interviewed her.
Now, was there any fallout from that? I mean, did you feel, I mean, was it made very clear to you that you were a minority on the faculty? I mean, that was pretty obvious.
It was pretty obvious, yeah.
But there wasn't a fight to get you here or anything that you had heard that...
Well, you know, I had heard after I got here and was pretty upset about it, as anybody would be, that, you know, the dean had said, you've got to hire a woman. And so I always just kind of, after I got mad about it, and I actually started looking for other jobs somewhere else, but and then I kind of got over that, and I just thought, well, they lucked out, you know.
Right.
So I've been here since then, and probably had a little rougher time than and probably didn't get as mentored as well as some of the men would have, and didn't get as much help and. So probably didn't get as much mentoring and help, and not really because anybody was not trying. I just don't think they really understood mm-hmm. how to do it or how to relate. But now I think we're a lot better. And of course, the faculty was fairly senior age. People that were toward the twilight of their careers at the time they got hired. And if you looked at the faculty list, it was just all these full professors and then practically no associate professors and all these, you know, young assistant professors, and I was one of those. And so, and the first years I was there, we had a number of retirements, people that were just, you know, retiring. And so the average age of the department was certainly dropping pretty quickly in those first years, and so there were a lot of assistant professors in the department, and so I just managed to find my way, and I guess probably because I was one of those third culture kids and was used to just sort of, you know, jumping into situations that where you didn't really know people and you didn't really know the unwritten rules of, you know, how they get along, and that it really never bothered me a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, probably did some things and, you know, could have had, you know, life would might have been a lot easier in some ways, but just took a while to figure it all out. So that's how I got here. And
how was the tenure process?
And my life.
How was your life between
my life,
when you got here and
then? Yeah, my life. So I came here and as a single person, and I met my my husband now just after tenure. So I dated and things like that, but wasn't really looking for all that serious of a relationship, I think. I had a lot of fun as an assistant professor, and I worked really hard and sort of managed to get through the tenure process. I got advice from some of the senior women in the College of Engineering, and I certainly remember Denise Denton was around at the time and was a great source of support, and many of us appreciated what she did for us, and just to sort of keep us all on the path, and her encouragement to help get us all through and her advice and so on. And so the tenure process was probably like most people's. I guess I wasn't really as worried about it, I think, as some of the assistant professors are now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because when you get through the tenure and then you realize how hard you worked to get there, and you're like, I worked this hard to keep this job. and then they dump more on you, as you go. But it is a wonderful lifestyle, and it's great not having to necessarily report to any particular people and people telling you what to do, and you get to choose what you'd like to work on and the direction you'd like to go. And so it does take a certain type of person to want to do that, mm-hmm. and to keep pushing in that area. And so the tenure puts you through those hurdles to make sure that they've got people who are very self-motivated and creative and willing to work and give up lots of other parts of their lives. So at any rate, I did get married finally, and we're settled here in Madison, and he's a local guy from Wisconsin, and so that sort of gives me more roots into the state. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting when I look back and realize that now I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere in my life. And so it's almost like this is my home, but of course all the people from Wisconsin still think I have a bit of an accent. Even my daughter, now I have a 7-year-old daughter, and she even catches things that don't sound local to her. And so one of them is when she asks me something and I say, I think so, and she said, I think so, Mom, not I ink so. So that's very Pittsburghese. And so I guess I got that from my parents. So that's a little bit of my life. And
well, talk about your research, because it sounds, just from what I have read, that it's changed.
Yeah. It has evolved a lot.
Yeah, talk about that.
I'm one of those people that don't like to do the same thing over and over again, and I know that's probably a little unusual, because I'm not saying all the researchers do the same thing all over and over again, but I do get interested in different things as I go. And so I came in with a lot of artificial intelligence, information management. So I was very much a management and data person. And when I got here, one of the most exciting things going on in the department was in the area of geographic information systems. And so I was able to link up with some of my colleagues who were very advanced experts in geospatial information. And so they had much more the geospatial component of this, and I had much more of the database component. And so we had people that were surveyors and map makers, and they knew spatial information, and I knew the non-spatial information that was the component, and how you manage that, and how you serve it, and how you make sure that things are consistent. And so that was really when database management systems were just being developed. And being used. And so We teamed up and we did quite a bit of really interesting stuff. Had done some work that was for the National Cooperative Highway Research Program on location referencing systems for transportation applications, and gone on to do multimodal, where we're not just looking at highways but also rail and air and transit, and how all of those different agencies and for business practices integrate data and manage it and be able to link information together. We started going off into civil infrastructure data. So now when you have the utilities as well as the roadways as well as all the other road furniture and other kinds of facilities that are out there, and linking all of that as integrated information sources, and working across a lot of the institutional barriers as well as some of the technical barriers and the logical information barriers. So we worked on some of those projects and solved a number of issues there, and certainly investigated a lot of those issues and worked with the Department of Transportation and other agencies on a lot of those issues. And then that evolved a bit into areas of enterprise data modeling and looking at really across business units. And so I started working a bit with some of the people in the business school. Mm-hmm. And so hence a lot of management type stuff started coming up. And then with my background in structural engineering and geotechnical engineering and in transportation organizations, I got, and some of the coursework I had taken while I was at Carnegie Mellon, I was very much interested in asset management of transportation facilities. And that doesn't mean, you know, where you're going to put things as much as it means on, again, custodians of those facilities. And so while civil engineers do a lot of designing and building new facilities, and most of our coursework is teaching students how to design and how to construct and teaching them material properties and so on, a lot of what's needed now, particularly since much of the infrastructure has already been built in our nation and in many parts of the world, is better ways to manage them. Mm-hmm. And efficiently manage them. And so how do we take care of all this stuff that we're building, and in particular our highway systems? And so I got into a lot of the maintenance, quality assurance, and asset management, and done a lot on bridge management systems, inventories of bridges, and not only their location but their condition, and how do we as a networks of bridges, and again, database management systems are a huge part of all of this. How do we manage those inventories, and how do we make decisions about where to spend the money so that we're maximizing the overall life cycle of our facilities and using the funding as most efficiently as possible, and some into pavement management systems, and then more recently into operations of winter operations, snow plowing. Mm-hmm. And I actually teamed up with one of my colleagues again, and we did some really fun work on where tracking devices and GPS tracking devices are installed on snow plows, and where do they go, and you know, and can we develop performance measures for winter operations. And so we did it. I did a lot of, again, I did kind of the non-spatial part, and my colleague did a lot of the spatial part. And so my work was on developing the performance measures and talking to people and what's important and, you know, how do we quantify this stuff. And so then we'd go back and use the data to run the calculations. And that work has gotten quite a bit of attention and has been used by others as they go on, and so I guess I'm rambling a bit, but there are a lot of interesting projects that we've done that are related to management of transportation facilities, and has have been working for the last 4 or 5 years with the Department of Transportation here on their maintenance quality assurance program, which is really what they're using to provide information to the governor and to the legislator about how the condition of the roadways. We're building up to developing reports. We do a report every year, and with a lot of collected information, it's sampled across the roadways. And so the counties go out and they'll inspect sampled sections of the roadway on really, you know, how's the pavement, how's the shoulders, and the litter and the mowing and weeds and things like that, and from the perspective of the motoring public. Mm-hmm. And so we've been developing report formats and developing statistical analysis of that and trying to help the state improve the data collection and what to collect and then how to report it and how to analyze it. And so every year we do a little tweaking on that, and that's been a really fun project.
And is that funded by the state?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. That's funded by the state. Everything I'm telling you is about funded either by the state or by the federal.
By the Federal Department of Transportation?
Yeah, or the National Cooperative Highway Research Program. Some of the GIS work that we did early on was funded by the National Science Foundation. Some of the early conceptual work on object-oriented data models and things that I had done, the Research Initiation Award, and then some follow-on grants. But mostly recently it's been USDOT money or state DOT money from Wisconsin, and then I've done a lot of work for other states as well. Mm-hmm. So in bridges and retaining walls, and then it's all, a lot of it's tied to highway maintenance and management of highway facilities. So then how did I get to where I am now? All right, mm-hmm. So we at the Department of Civil Engineering faculty worked together to put in a proposal for a regional university transportation center. And in 1999, we were awarded that center. And the topic for the center, the thematic area that we had proposed, was optimization of investment. And that meant different things to different people. To me, of course, it meant investment of funds into, you know, development of facilities, and that could be new facilities or maintenance of existing facilities. And the way agencies are sectioned, or the way the funding to agencies gets allocated into pots, there's certain funding, which a lot of it comes from the federal return from fuel taxes, is allocated to new construction and not to ongoing maintenance, whereas state tax dollars have to go to ongoing maintenance. And so this is a big issue for, so, you know, it's a little easier to get the money to build new stuff, but not as easy to get the money to maintain things. And it's really not a very good way to do that, because it actually gives a disincentive to maintenance. And that's changing now more and more as, you know, new transportation bills come along. But so in the area of our transportation center, I'm one of the few faculty actually really, really work in that area. A lot of the other ones are more hard engineering. We worked with the Wisconsin DOT and brought in someone who had been a former division administrator, who's not an engineer, who worked with, was an administrator for the in the Division of Transportation Investment Management. So he held the purse strings for the organization, for the agency is wide, and he came in and helped us establish our center. And he and I quickly hooked up together, and because he was, you know, the person who actually practiced. And so that was a great relationship, and I still have working relationships with him. He's now retired, and then I came on as the full director. So I was the associate director under him, and then when he retired, I became the director. But that was another really, really good working relationship that I've had. And so we've done lots of good things and with our regional center. And the center's somewhat of a funding source. So we do activities, but we're also a funding source. It was to the region. So it's funded by the USDOT to the 7 state, to us as the lead state for the 7 state region, which is called the Midwest region. And so that includes Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and who am I missing?
Iowa?
No, Iowa's in region 6. Who did I miss? Minnesota?
Illinois,
Ohio,
Michigan.
Yeah, I said Michigan. Okay, maybe it's 6 there. Anyway, look at the, well, we have another one. No, actually, I'm sorry, it's 6. I'm okay. Confusing that because we did another project, which we called the Upper Midwest Freight Corridor, and that's how we got into freight, and we brought in Iowa. Okay, so that's with the 7 states. Okay, and then from there, we were able to get 3 more states to come in, and this is called the Mississippi Valley region, and that's the USDOT ASHTO Mississippi Valley region. So we actually have work now. I'm leading work that's funded by 10 states in the region, which is 20% of the U.S., to do freight research. And that's part of, you know, that's kind of today's situation. So we've gone from the asset management of very focused in our state to focused outside our state, bringing in additional, and now we're into freight. And we started doing a lot of the freight research before freight issues were on the forefront that like they are now. Mm-hmm. So we were doing it way before the last transportation bill and for the safety loop bill. And we were designated as a national transportation center. So we lost the bid for our regional center. And the way that really happened was a lot of politics in that one. So we were, I like to think, and now I'm bragging, and that's okay because it's true, we were a poster child for a regional center. I mean, we actually worked with other states and other universities and got recognized quite a bit for our work as a regional center. But we were designated in the transportation bill as a national center, which is a $16 million designation. Of course, after appropriation cuts, it's, but we're well funded for the work that we want to do. So we're quite comfortable and have what we need to do work and looking for lots of partners, in particular with our state DOT and working with lots of faculty who are interested in the area. The transportation bill came out, and then with that bill then came the new regional university transportation center program. And so because we already were a regional program and wanted to continue with that, we wrote a proposal to do that, but we didn't get it. And it's probably because we already had the national center, and it was like we were being a little bit too piggish. But we were a good regional center. No reason why we couldn't do both. But and so our regional center technically ends in 08. So there's a little bit of overlap from the national center. And so we're in the process right now of winding down the regional center and gearing up the national center. So we are a national center, National University Transportation Center. And the interesting part about it is because even though we're a national center, and as the name implies, we have actually a lot more flexibility to choose our partners and who we want to work with, and we're under no obligation or no unwritten obligation to fund other universities, and like we were with the regional center. Mm-hmm. And so it really was, a school within the region. So that's the National Center, and it's a center for freight infrastructure research and education. And that's a lot of what I'm doing right now today, is gearing up that center.
Okay, talk about some of the freight issues. Just what are they that you're going to be looking at?
Freight right now is very, very important, and for a lot of reasons. And one is that the growth of freight and the demand for freight in the U.S. and just in the last several years, how many trucks are on the roads, and that, if you look at graphs and the growth of freight compared to the growth of passenger vehicles, it's several times larger. Hmm. And so a lot of this is really an outfall of the just-in-time logistics. And so literally, our highways are becoming warehouses. So things are on the highways.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so our highways and our railways and our airways and are becoming warehouses. And these are facilities that are built, for public use and for okay, so we were talking about highways as warehouses, and I guess the what I really wanted to point out on that issue is that the impact on the global competitiveness of the United States as a result of that. And as congestion grows, that our nation becomes less competitive in the global economy because how much we depend on our transportation system. We have a world-class transportation system, and our competitive edge in many ways is dependent upon that transportation system. And so as congestion on 9094 from Chicago to Minneapolis increases, that makes Chicago further away from Minneapolis, and that costs money, time and money. And so if you look at farm to market, and even with some of our commodities that we do ship across outside the U.S., and you look at the cost breakdown on the various parts of that transfer, you will see that our transportation costs are much lower than in other parts of the world. And while our production costs are higher, our transportation costs are much lower. And as congestion increases, that's eaten into our competitive edge. And this is really serious and a big concern of the U.S. Department of Transportation, as well as a lot of our manufacturers. I was talking to some people at the Port of Milwaukee just last couple of days, and we're putting together a proposal to work with them on looking at freight ferry from the Port of Milwaukee to the Port of Muskegon, Michigan. And the story there, and one of the motivations there, is an example of how important this transportation is to economic competitiveness, is that Miller Brewing production in Milwaukee no longer serves Michigan and Detroit area. That's going now to Pennsylvania. Because of transportation costs, because of the cost to move that product through the congestion in Chicago.
Oh, sure.
They can't even compete with their own, their own same company competitors, and so they lost that part of the market. Hmm. So these are just a couple illustrations of the issues with freight. And, when the U.S. Department of Transportation was developed, and each of the states were it formed the state departments of transportation, or state highway, or state departments of transportation. At some point, they were highway agencies, but now they're not just highway, but all of transportation. And sort of chunked that up, and the way the U.S. Department of Transportation works with those state transportation agencies, it made sense to work within each state when distances were a big issue. And so, but now in our national economy and our global economy, distance isn't really the issue anymore. We've spanned the distance. Now, to stay competitive, we have to coordinate across state boundaries. And states haven't been used to doing this. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of concern about getting their fair share of the federal tax dollars that go, and
concern with getting federal dollars for projects within their own states without necessarily looking at the connectivity across states and across borders and in regions. And so our center has been a big promoter of that. We have been the facilitator for the 10 states within the Mississippi Valley region, which is the same six that I mentioned, plus Ohio, Kentucky, Missouri, and now we've lost another. Somebody's missing. And so that the 10 state region, we are who is that last? This is embarrassing. But anyway, we've been facilitating those 10 states to look at freight issues across the region, and we worked with them in a workshop and then developed testimony that we got the Director of Transportation from Michigan, Michigan Department of Transportation, and myself. I gave testimony to the Commission of Surface Transportation and Finance in Minneapolis a couple weeks ago, on behalf of the 10 states, and pointing out the issues for transportation and the need for regional approaches, the need for looking at our transportation system not as individual systems, such as just the highway system and the rail system and the air system and the intermodal facilities, but really as a connected set of systems. We do a lot to optimize across each of those systems. A lot of the transportation engineers are looking at, you know, optimizing flow of transportation on the highways. We have private sector people looking at optimizing the flow on the railways, and decisions on highways impact the flow on rail and vice versa, and we don't look at that. Even in intermodal facilities, you know, the intermodal facility itself is optimizing the activities going on for that facility and not really looking at, you know, the flow of vehicles that are coming in and the flow of rail. So the need to integrate across those, and that's going to be tough. Mm-hmm. And even water, you know, they what we were talking about in the port of Milwaukee, and some of the big barriers there are really the harbor maintenance tax, which says that every time you transfer a load from one mode to another, you know, from onto waters, you have to pay this water the harbor maintenance tax, which is based on the value of the load. And we don't do that on highways, and so there's some issues with that, and the Jones Act on really whether, you know, how to build efficiently and economically build some of the vessels that are needed for water transportation. So in Europe, there's a lot of, they've made really good use of their inland waterways, and we don't do that quite as much here. There's a lot of environmental concerns which we need to address and or need to satisfy, but there's certainly a lot of capacity there. So with our center and with the research that I'm doing right now, we're doing a lot of the engineering analysis that's needed to provide information for policy decisions.
It's
very
exciting.
It's wonderful job. It's great. I get to talk to a lot of people. I get to really learn what some of the real world issues are.
Sure.
And then go out and get the data and look at it and investigate. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these issues. And it's a great job. It's a great position to be in.
What about your teaching role?
So my teaching role, when I first got here, because I did a lot of computing and database and things like that, I developed some new courses. Mm-hmm. I had done what was called computer tools for engineers and taught that for a while, and then and other departments wanted to do that, and I don't remember exactly how the story was, but it's kind of interesting from my perspective on how it all felt played out. Was then all of a sudden there was a time when a lot of the engineering departments were deciding that maybe their undergraduate students didn't need to know how to do computer programming, but really needed to use tools, and so they started desiring courses like mine. Well, I didn't want to teach that to the whole whole College of Engineering, and I was just this assistant professor. And it was a new course in our department, it was required in our department, and then computer science took it over. And I can remember when we developed our course that they didn't want us to call it, use the word computer in the course. And so, I guess it was, and so I ended up calling it problem solving for engineers or something like that. And so, and then when they, when they developed their course, they called it problem solving for engineers. And of course, we didn't bother them, but they taught that for a while. And I think now it's back up in the air again. I think there's a 2010 proposal to look at that. So that was one of the early things that I contributed as far as teaching. And aside from that, I'd done some of the economic analysis courses and some of the decision tool courses. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm on a working with some other faculty, industrial engineering and nuclear engineering, engineering physics. We've just been given an award to do one of the 2010 proposals, and we're looking at a certificate in risk analysis, mm-hmm. which is really important mm-hmm. in transportation mm-hmm. sector. And so that spins develops very is a nice development for the other types of courses that I've been doing in the department. I've more recently, within the last several years, had worked on getting the approval for a certificate in transportation management and policy. And I actually wrote also a cluster hire proposal that went through, and that was on the last round of the cluster hire. And the proposal got selected, let's say, but then there wasn't funding.
Oh.
So that was really a disappointment. And that was one of the things that I had done for our regional transportation center. And one of the activities we had said to the DOT that we were going to do was develop this certificate and develop an educational program. So I had all the components. I had the certificate program, which was was supposed to be the glue that held the cluster hire faculty together, and the curriculum and drawing in the students and everything. And then we wrote the cluster hire proposal, and we got that selected, and then that would have brought in more faculty around this transportation management policy certificate. And even though the cluster hire hasn't been funded yet, we still keep reminding everybody about this. That's why I'm mentioning it.
Okay, good.
So we hope we'll still get that thing funded. And the certificate program has been quite successful. We're graduating two or three of them this year. And for something that really doesn't have much more faculty than me, and some other faculty that do work with me, I'm not going to take all the credit for that. We have a lot of excellent transportation faculty, and we just hired another woman in our department, and she's been wonderful, and just a lot of help. Jessica Guo, who's a new assistant professor, is working on that with me. So I went through the approval process for that certificate, and that was quite an interesting experience, because it did touch on urban and regional planning. It touched on the business school. It touched on La Follette School of Public Affairs, and then of course civil engineering, and we found a home for it in the Institute for Environmental Studies, and so the Gaylord Nelson Institute mm-hmm. is the home for that, and we do have a heavy environmental focus, which is very Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and in that program we've developed a new course which is environmental impacts of transportation to support that certificate program. And we have a couple other courses that we developed for that. One is a colloquium where we identify a topic every year. This year it's, or this semester it's a history of history of transportation. And so it has a good flavor because it just helps the students understand how we got here and how legislation mm-hmm. sort of gave us what we have. And so the engineers tend to want to solve things, and well, it really would be very simple to do this, and so they don't really understand the social and the political barriers that are out there. And so this was meant to help the students understand the legislation that, impacts mm-hmm. the practice of engineering. And then we have something that we call a practicum, where we have a group of students that draws from the certificate students, which are, we do have public affairs students and urban planning students and environmental studies students, as well as civil engineers. So we do tend to have a mix of those in each semester. It's, you know, a different mix. Mm-hmm. But we put them in groups, and I like to describe it as a consulting firm kind of thing. So they are the consulting firm, and each of them has their expertise on this consulting project, and they've got to learn to communicate and work together. And so we go, it's fun to go and work with the DOT and get projects for this, because then you get real world projects, and you get real world data, and you get real world issues, and then you get a real world client. And so we've done some interesting things. One of them was the economic impacts of ferry systems within the, most of those are passenger ferries, and within the state of Wisconsin. And so we were able to measure that and give some really good feedback to the state on that for a brochure that they put out on the economic impact of the various modes. And that did lead into then this freight ferry work that we did. We've done some planning work. This semester we did one with on freight planning in small MPOs, Metropolitan Planning Organizations. And so we did some surveying, a survey of the planning activities within small to mid-size MPOs across the whole region. The students collected information and did a survey and web-based survey and collected the data and wrote a report. So those are some of the courses. This next fall I'm going to do a course on freight transportation. So a lot of the work, and for the certificate program I also developed a course on the management of infrastructure systems. So a lot of my teaching and developing of courses has been to support the research programs that I've been directing and been involved in. That's another nice luxury of being at the University of Wisconsin, is that you get a lot of freedom to do that.
Now, obviously, you've worked with a lot of people across campus. Would you talk about the climate for women on the Madison campus? Do you think it helps or hinders the advancement of women?
That's a really good question. I think generally the climate is actually fairly good, and I think that's because of the city. I think it's probably better here than it is in a lot of the other Midwest. And many other Midwest universities. And when I first got here, it was a little tough. It was a little bit different. I mean, the mindset of many of the colleagues, particularly in the College of Engineering, were just a little bit different than I was used to. And again, because of my background and stuff, I can tend to just ignore it or, you know, not let it slow me down. And generally, I felt like it had come to recognize that sort of on the West Coast or the East Coast, it seemed to be a little bit more progressive for women than in the Midwest. I think we're catching up. It's certainly, in some ways, being in the College of Engineering, in some weird ways, it was actually an advantage because people were a little more, while it was a disadvantage for many of your day-to-day activities and working and trying to build collaborations and to build the recognition for your work and so on that you know, many of the men might have done, it in some ways might have slowed you down. But then when it came to the tenure process, people were really kind of, you know, careful that they were you know, doing a little bit more evaluating and careful to be fair. And so I think that, so there are some advantages and disadvantages that maybe compensate for each other, and that seems fair and rightfully compensating. You know, that's, that I think that's an advantage. So while probably cross campus, I think we're doing some of that. And the college has done, and the university's done a lot of with the gender equity, pay, and sort of, you know, doing some things that are forcing people to look at themselves. But I still see, you know, some things that are going on that, where some conversations go on that I think wouldn't have been described that way if it had been a man. And and you call them on it, and sometimes it, you know, it's just learning how to how to address those without totally alienating people, but getting them to understand or to see something from another perspective.
Sure.
And so I don't know if I'm answering your question there on the climate for women. I think it's a great school.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the women are great. You know, we don't, I don't see any of these ones that are, what are the queen bee type things, or people talk about that. Certainly not in the College of Engineering. I think we're all pretty smart to realize,
yeah,
we're in this together, and if we're not going to support each other, who is, you know?
Right.
So, and we've got some great women faculty. It's been tough to get them here because of the, you know, where while we have a lot of spousal hire initiatives, I'm not sure that it's been frustrating that many of those haven't been as effective as they really should be.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is really the faculty governance type things where we just,
sure,
and I'm sure other people have said that. And while I think it's great that we're trying to do things, I think the faculty governance in some way is hurting us,
mm-hmm,
in being able to achieve some of those goals. Although we've been really successful, I'm very, very, very happy that we now have two other women in my department. They're both assistant professors. Another one's going to be up for tenure very soon. And we have an offer out to another woman who could be joining us soon. That's a spousal hire issue, and so I know that they've been given dual offers from a couple other universities, so we may lose that one, but let's hope we don't. So that's a little bit about me and my thinking and the way the university is right now, and it's treating me, and right now I'm doing quite well. On a private note, I guess, the department and the university and the college, department of the college in particular, have been very supportive. I went through some cancer treatment just recently, and I'm recovering on that, and so I had Hodgkin's disease, and my department was great. And my colleagues were just wonderful, just taking care of me, and the staff here in the center were just wonderful. And so it was quite a growing experience for me, and we're doing quite well. So that's the part, that's kind of the timestamp.
Well,
on
I know,
this interview.
Yeah, I do want you to just comment on honors and awards you've received, because I want that on tape. And
on
I
tape, too.
Yes.
So I'm not really good at sort of tooting my own horn like I should be. And so one of the necessities of this job is keeping your vita up to date. And so I constantly look at that in the annual report. And so years go by, and I look at that, and I'm like, I forgot to put some papers down on the thing. But, you know, I've won some Best Paper Awards and Research Initiation Awards from the National Science Foundation, and have been recognized for a lot of service in early years, and working with in the American Society of Civil Engineers, and working with in particular that the Division of Computing, and in a lot of leadership positions there, and I kind of think of that as, you know, my early career.
Mm-hmm.
And as of late, I've been much more active in the Transportation Research Board, and just recently been appointed to a couple committees, one on intermodal transportation, another on ferry transportation.
Mm.
And so I've been active in those committees, and working in the National Cooperative Highway Research Program on various panels overseeing research activities.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things that I really like to do. On campus, I've been nominated for the Cabinet 99 Awards and CalEd Awards, and but haven't been successful in getting those.
Yet.
Not yet. So that's some of the awards activities, and I love my job.
Great. It comes through.
I love my job, and I love the people I'm working with, and it's just great, and it's wonderful being at the stage of your career where there's so many opportunities for you that you really literally can pick and choose. Yeah. What you want to work with, and it can be dependent on the people you're working with too. I mean, there's some people that are just great to work with and some that aren't. So many choices, you get to pick, and it's fun working with new people and working across campus, and it's fun working with new young faculty and mentoring young faculty and getting them going and helping them build careers. And so I get a lot of joy out of that. Mm-hmm. And probably in some sense at the expense of my own, but you know, I'm having a great job and are having a great time working in my job, and wonderful. So I just do what I like to do.
Well, thank you very much. I don't want to turn the tape off if there's anything.
Thank you for doing this.
Well, I really appreciate
your time.
Excellent interview. Thank you.
Thank you.